This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 23, 2005. More than 2.5 years after the invasion of Iraq, Iraqis are increasingly organizing nonviolently against the U.S. military presence as guerrillas continue to carry out attacks against U.S. troops, the Iraqi military, and civilian targets. Today, we'll take a look at some of Iraq's most important developments in the last year. I'm Aura Bogado. Please stay with us. As Saddam Hussein and his closest associates wait for their fates to be decided by the U.S.-backed Iraqi government, politics at the ground level are taking shape, with some Iraqi factions turning their guns against each other. During the last year, events such as January's elections and a referendum on the country's constitution in October have been hailed by the Bush administration as landmark moments in the country's path to democracy. But violence in the country has continued to escalate, and there is no end in sight to the fighting. The country appears increasingly divided, and accusations of sectarian killings have become common. Most Iraqis see a civil war taking place amidst the military struggle against the occupation. Our correspondent David Enders has been reporting for FSRN from Baghdad since summer 2004 and takes a look at the last year in Iraq.
It is Saturday, but half a dozen of the Baghdad School of Ballet and Music students have come in anyway to practice. 14-year-old Zahal Ahmed has been playing piano since she was 5.
It's my biggest dream now is to go to the Royal College of Music in London to study there, and then I could back to play with the National Symphony.
The school was burned and looted following the U.S. invasion, and has the misfortune of being located near Mathana Airport, a U.S. military base and Iraqi army recruiting center that has been attacked frequently since the beginning of the occupation, often killing dozens of recruits queued up outside the gate. As Ahmed spoke, the doors of the school rattled lightly from another explosion.
Everyone thinks that Iraq will be not good. Well, I think it'll be better than before. With us, with the new generation, that could make it better.
Standing in line with hundreds of others in front of Abu Ghraib prison, Iqbal Ali Qadim breaks into tears at the mention of her 12-year-old son, Ali.
Miss Katli.
I just wanted to be out. The last time I visited him, he told me they had beat him. He said they put him in the hospital for 3 days. They think he was going to be a suicide bomber.
Ali, along with his father, two older brothers, and a pair of uncles, were arrested from Qadim's home in Yusufiya, south of Baghdad, 2 months ago. Tomorrow, she says, she will make the day-long trip to Camp Buka in Qusr, south of Basra, where Ali's brothers and uncles are being held, accused of supporting the insurgency. Many of the families outside Abu Ghraib, which, along with Buka, accounts for almost all of the detainees the U.S. holds in Iraq, complain of arrests that take all the men from a family and that the prisoners are being split up. The number of prisoners held by the U.S. military swelled to more than 10,000 in January and has remained above that since. In addition to Buka and Abu Ghraib, there are about 1,400 unregistered detainees at various military bases around the country. Those facilities are not monitored by the Red Cross or the Iraqi Ministry of Human Rights, which do monitor Buka and Abu Ghraib. For many families, the arrest represent the departure of the primary wage earner.
I have no money. I cannot collect my husband's pension because they took his ID when he was arrested.
Others are simply frightened of what might be happening since revelations of torture inside the prisons in 2004. One man was waiting to see his son, who had been in the prison for more than a year. The man said that he had come to visit twice before, but that the visits had been rescheduled.
They told me he was sick, then the translator told me he had been interrogated.
That the U.S. military continues to operate freely inside the country has become an important issue for Iraqi politicians. Salama al-Hafaji was a member of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council and ran in January's national elections as a member of the coalition of mostly religious Shiite parties that took most of the vote. Al-Hafaji is seen as having been close to the U.S. project in Iraq since its inception, but blames the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority, headed by Paul Bremer, a former Reagan appointee and terrorism consultant, for setting the country on its current course.
When Mr. Bremer came to Iraq, we have no terrorism. But when he left, we have a big numbers of them. And he was a specialist in fighting terrorism.
In June, Al-Hafaji was one of 82 signatories in the 275-member parliament of a letter circulated by another MP calling for a vote on the status of foreign militaries in Iraq.
These forces have to have a schedule for their leaving from Iraq first and having a schedule of the preparing of the Iraqi forces in different sites and making an agreement for their presence. And it had been done in Turkish, in Germany, in Japan, and they call it SOFA.
Al-Hafaji, who heads the Assembly's Human Rights Committee, says that a timetable for withdrawal could slow recruitment of jihadis from inside and outside the country.
It will affect those who are with extreme religious ideas. This will affect them. That the American troops is now, you are speaking about that American troops, these American troops having this type of aims and they are going to withdraw, and this will decrease the reasons. Nowadays, you have seen that the terrorist action have been increased. Why? Because new groups are growing. Young men or even old men, they are collecting together, making new groups and working against the American troops or against Shia.
Al-Hafaji, like many Iraqis, feel prisons like Abu Ghraib have become recruiting centers for resistance fighters rather than deterrents. Sources within the resistance have confirmed as much.
In the prisons, especially the biggest ones, like Al-Matar or Abu Ghraib, you know that the prisoners which go inside the prisons, they are collected together, the terrorists and those the innocents. And when they go out of the prisons, they taught them how to be terrorists. So when they are innocent and they get out of the prison, they became new terrorists.
Asked if the ratification of a new constitution in October would slow the guerrilla war, Al-Hafaji insisted that a trial for Saddam Hussein would be more important, to prove to some of those continuing to fight that the restoration of Hussein's government would never occur. In January, Iraqis went to the polls amidst gunfire and mortar attacks and the heaviest security the country had seen since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Despite a complete ban on civilian vehicle traffic, hundreds of mortar attacks were heard across the capital, and the death toll was almost certainly higher than the 34 reported killed at polling stations by the Ministry of Interior. In Thawra, a heavily Shiite district of Baghdad, election officials said turnout was better than 50% by midday. Polls opened at 7 a.m., but voters trickled in until mid-morning, when lines began to form. Dia Fakir was in charge of voting at Batul Elementary School.
We didn't expect this number of people to come. Many, many people have come. And it's the same when I call the other polling stations. They tell me people are happy and throwing chocolates.
Many of those in Thawra indicated that they voted for List 169, the so-called Shiite list, headed by Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Abdul Hadar Khatayr, a representative of the cleric, was on hand in the neighborhood, checking with representatives of the party who had been accredited as election monitors. He praised the orderliness of the election and said informal exit polls indicated a strong showing for the party. As he spoke, an Iraqi soldier on the roof of the polling station took aim at a group of men in a car who were attempting to launch mortar rounds, but the voting continued.
The commission authority has been doing a very good job. They've given many young men and women training courses. People from different parties are acting as election monitors. I think it'd be very hard to fix the vote. But even if there was some corruption, that is normal. It happens in every election. I've been getting calls from polling stations all day, and we think that Baghdad, Basra, Karbala, and Najaf, we have 80% of the vote.
Al-Hakim, the formerly exiled cleric who essentially served as the list's representative, is clear on his vision for the country. In an exclusive with FSRN after the election, he spoke on the subject of the occupation.
Iraqi people want a full pullout for the American forces. There is no one in Iraq who welcomes the Americans to be staying in Iraq. And we are working to make the American forces and the non-American forces no longer exist. There is no nation in this world that's free and has dignity that would agree to have foreign forces on its land.
Military action against Iran by the U.S., Hakim said, would be met with anger by Iraqis. Hakim, like many other members of the new government, spent time in exile in Iran after Saddam Hussein's purges against his party and others in 1980.
From the beginning, we have made it clear that we don't accept to have Iraq as a base to bomb any of the neighboring countries, especially Iran.
Hakim said he believes the U.S. tampered with the results of January's voting and that his party received more than the 51% of the votes that final tallies suggested, but that they had decided to move on and that forming a new government was more important. Many Iraqis, journalists, and other observers expressed surprise at the voter turnout. But Sadoun al-Dulaimi, Iraq's most prominent pollster and now the Minister of Defense, expected it, based on a poll of 5,000 Iraqi citizens he and his employees took 3 days before the election.
And those who said we are going to participate in upcoming election, despite the all difficulties, those more than 80%.
The poll was not conducted in the largely Sunni provinces of Nineveh, Salahuddin, Diyala, and Anbar because of intimidation and assassination of anyone having to do anything with elections, though Dulaimi's employees were able to get numbers from Ramadi, the capital of Anbar, because Dulaimi's tribe is based there and provided the necessary protection for the enterprise.
Most of the people, you can say 90%, boycott. I said for this or that reason, because they don't know nothing about the election and the procedures and the law and so on. Alongside with that, some groups fully adopt to prevent the people from the next election.
Dulaimi said more than 85% of those polled in the same survey said they would like U.S. troops to leave urgently.
The first survey we conducted in May 2003, we asked the Iraqis if they perceive the coalition troops as a liberation troops or occupation or occupied troops. The majority at that time perceived them as a liberated troops.
Though he is Sunna, Dulaimi's biggest problem has come from the actions of the former minister, who allegedly plundered millions meant to buy arms from Lebanon. But the MOD isn't the only government operation plagued by corruption and shortages of equipment, funds, and electricity. Using a generator in the street in front of the Ministry of Oil, supporters of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr from across the country pray as part of a 3-day sit-in to call attention to the country's fuel shortage. Iraq is importing more than $200 million worth of fuel from neighboring countries each month, but supplies are often low, especially in the capital, because of attacks on pipelines, corruption, and the killing and kidnapping of tanker truck drivers. Baghdadis who can afford it are now often buying cooking gas, kerosene, and gasoline on the black market at prices about the same as those in the U.S., between $2 and $3 per gallon for petrol, though a good wage in the country is $200 per month. The alternative is waiting in 2-day lines at petrol stations, which often run out of fuel. Ministry of Oil spokesman Asim Jihad declined to answer questions on the matter of smuggling, other than to say that the oil minister had requested help from the Ministry of Interior, which controls the police and the Iraqi National Guard, in combating the smuggling. Jihad instead focused on the attacks against the pipelines, many of which have potentially occurred with the intent of cutting off the capital. The demonstration also underscored the shakiness of the ceasefire between Sadr's men and American troops. As the men demonstrated outside the ministry, a U.S. patrol drove by. A pair of troops got out of the lead Humvee, aggressively pointing their rifles at the unarmed crowd as a cleric urged calm over the public address.
Muhammad.
After a few tense moments, the troops returned to their Humvee and drove away, the gunners on top of all three Humvees still training their arms on the crowd. The leader of the demonstration, a cleric from Baghdad, shrugged and just offered a simple observation. "You see," he asked, his point proven for him, "this is their manner." The music of Hatem al-Iraqi, a singer from Sadr City, would be an unlikely sound on the streets of Basra these days. The country's third largest city with more than 1 million people, Basra looks much as it did when Iraq was invaded more than 2 years ago. Garbage lays in burning curbside piles outside the governor's office, and streets are flooded with sewage. Local residents look to the government to provide better services, but a mixture of alleged corruption and complaints of a lack of support from the central government have left efforts largely stymied. Mohammed Sadoun is the governor of Basra province. In January's local election, his Fadila party took 12 seats on the 42-seat governing council, giving it the largest voting bloc. In June, Sadoun called for a one-day strike of the workers in the nearby Rumaila oil fields, the country's largest, to emphasize his demands that Baghdad provide a greater share of the oil wealth Rumaila produces. He cited the semi-autonomy of the country's northern Kurdish region as a model, and said that more non-violent actions would follow if the central government did not respond.
"I should not go to Baghdad. It's the will of the people, and I gave them the demands of the people. It's the government that should discuss these demands with the people in the city. According to Article 25 of the law passed by Bremer, the rights have been given to the people of the cities. The people of Basra ask for the same rights of the Kurds."
Other politicians in the city, though in agreement that the south has been neglected by the central government and that they would like greater autonomy, felt the strike was a power play by the governor, and said that policemen loyal to Fadila prevented workers from entering the fields. The country's new constitution, ratified in October, gives provincial governments powers they never possessed before, and in the case of Basra, greater control locally of oil revenues. In protest of Sadoun's call for a strike, members of other parties walked out of a meeting of the provincial council. Fawad Mazani is a member of the Basra Islamic Party, and accused Fadila of widespread corruption and cronyism, though he would not say the name of the party aloud.
"In the last 3 months, a lot of decisions that we have made have not been implemented. This made troubles for us with the people of Basra. We should bring jobs to people regardless of the parties they belong to, but the jobs have been given to the people from one party. This will drive people to one party or another. The people of Basra, because of their suffering, are very sensitive to actions taken by one party or another, inside the governorate or outside."
Basra has been a conservative city since the 1980s, and liberal Muslims, as well as Christians, see their rights eroding under a police force that is largely made up of members of Fadila and other local Islamic parties, and thus do not put pressure on religious militants. Asked why no arrests were made by the police following an assault on students at Basra University in March by followers of Sadr because the students were dancing co-ed and playing music, Sadoun offered a simple answer.
"Nobody came to complain."
Basra is publicly dry of alcohol, and some CD stores have been attacked, presumably for carrying titles deemed un-Islamic. A translator working with the British military said he had been threatened repeatedly by men claiming loyalty to Sadr, whose followers in the city are political rivals of Fadila. Niall Stanley is a Christian who says he voted for Fadila because of his respect for their party, and said that in the case of Sadr's followers attacking students, the organization was not to blame.
"Yes, they closed our club, but not our club only. Some club, it's drinking alcohol. They feel that that's not good about the Islamic. Also, some people, not all people. For example, I give you my example. My family. Some of his people, they do very, very good work. They help the people, they help the NGOs, and sometimes they help to get the garbage from the street."
Basra
Basra is not the only part of the country where people feel abandoned by the central government. In Fallujah, 30 miles west of Baghdad, men at Al-Furqan Mosque weep as the imam calls for a unified Iraq and an end to the city's suffering. In July, 8 months after the second invasion of the city, there is hardly a street that does not still feature a building pulverized during the assault. I had not been in the city for more than a year, and though I had expected it, the destruction was still shocking. The dome of one mosque I had previously used as a landmark was completely missing. Large holes had been blown in others. Houses had been pancaked, and it was hard to find a facade without the mark of at least small arms fire. As many as 80% of the city's 300,000-plus residents had returned, but the city has by no means returned to normal. The police were hard at work adding razor wire and new concrete blast barriers to the already sprawling fortifications around their main station in the center of town, while U.S. and Iraqi army patrols traversed the main street, the Iraqis firing their rifles in the air to clear traffic. Small arms chattered on the south side of the city, followed by the response from a larger gun. The tension was palpable. Curfew begins at 10 p.m., but low-level fighting continues. I have heard Iraqis make comparisons between their occupation and the occupation of Palestine, but it wasn't until I saw families walking through the kilometer-long checkpoint, from a parking lot outside Fallujah to one on the other side of the highway, that it seemed cogent. Once inside, seeing the life continuing amidst the rubble, it was harder still to ignore the physical similarities. At Fallujah General Hospital, Doctors Ahmed and Salam, who agreed to be interviewed on the condition their names be changed, lamented the condition of the city and its people. The doctors said that in the last week they had received 3 civilian casualties as a result of U.S. fire, and that the week had been below average. Normally, said Dr. Ahmed, they saw 1 to 2 dead civilians each day, and that hundreds had been killed since the city was taken over by the U.S.
Just yesterday, a middle-aged lady was reached with her family, shooted by the coalition forces, and the direct hit in the head. After that, the coalition forces was come to our hospitals to make investigation about the events.
Residents of the city complained of continued arbitrary raids and arrests by the U.S. military and Iraqi army. Ahmed again.
Any family in Fallujah, when loss or miss some of their relative, they regard him dead by coalition forces till proven otherwise. That's the rule.
U.S. troops continue to occupy homes and bases inside the city, giving the population a continued feeling of siege, said Dr. Salam.
The population or people of Fallujah feel depressed because they can't move freely, they can't make social relationship to each other, because you see the coalition forces and the Iraqi National Guard every day make a new checkpoint, make a new obstacle. There is limited time to move freely. Many cases you see need urgent medical interference, such as the heart disease, may die because they can't reach hospital and take the initial first aid and initial medication.
The result, he continued, is predictable.
The battle will continue because when you harm people, even civilian people, will change to the fighters. So we regard Fallujah as large prison.
Most of the reconstruction that has taken place since the fighting has been the often partial rebuilding of houses. Residents have received some compensation from the Iraqi government, but the doctors said it is not enough. Some residents said they were wary of rebuilding their homes because of the possibility of further fighting. Dr. Salam again.
They just rebuild their houses, their old houses, and that's it. Many of them get paid for their destroyed houses of lower minimum requirements. It may cost more than 50 million, at least. What the one do if he got 3 million? Furthermore, they get suffer from being get out of their homes, and being shooted, they've been killed. Every family gets someone from their family, at least one of them, killed. Which is just the simple truth.
The destruction in places like Fallujah has been integral to the way Iraqis have witnessed the war. Fatlah Hassan is a National Assembly representative from Sadr City, the northern Baghdad neighborhood where fighters loyal to al-Sadr fought fierce street battles with U.S. troops in the summer of 2004. Despite the continued arrests of Sadr representatives by U.S. troops, which have resulted in skirmishes, a ceasefire between the groups has held. In addition to occasional violence, Sadr's followers have focused on non-violent actions, such as organizing demonstrations across the country in March. Hassan has spearheaded the drive within the assembly to push for withdrawal.
Pulling out American troops from Iraq is the demand of the people of Iraq. In March, millions of people came out to demonstrations seeking the pullout of American troops. We are seeking them to stop torturing and terrifying people and killing Iraqis.
Hassan says that if Iraq were truly a sovereign country, as the U.S. government claims, the issue of whether U.S. troops would remain would be put to a vote within the elected assembly, rather than be left to the decision of Prime Minister Ibrahim Jaafari, who has refused to call for a timetable for U.S. withdrawal. Hassan's appeal will likely gain momentum after the results from December's National Assembly elections are tallied. Sunnis are expected to vote in great number, and Sadr, for the first time, has officially encouraged his followers to participate in the political process. Despite the increased participation, Iraqi politics are likely to remain fractious, and militancy appears to be gaining acceptance. The narrow passage of the country's draft constitution in October may be a window into what is to come. Many Sunnis feel the intent of Shiite politicians is to force through laws that favor religious governments and the fragmentation of the state. Adnan al-Dulaimi is the former head of the Sunnah Pious Endowment Board, a government-funded Sunnah charity. He was removed from the position by Jaafari in July, and his house has been raided repeatedly by the U.S. military. Dulaimi has been particularly outspoken on the constitutional process.
The National Assembly is under the Shiite religious leadership and the Kurds. The National Assembly is going to vote on the draft of the Constitution, and we suggest that they postpone the writing of the Constitution until the next election, and they should elect a new National Assembly. On the subject of federalism, it will lead to the splitting of the center and the south. All of them believe in religious authority in the government, and it is not beyond our beliefs that they may take the government in the direction of Iran.
Miriam Arais, elected as part of the Shiite coalition in January, said the constitution drafting process was bogged down by Sunni demands.
It's with the Sunni Arabs, the new brothers. Their argument is that federalism will divide Iraq. We call them the New Brothers because they are new members in the Constitutional Committee.
To prevent ratification of the Constitution, two-thirds of voters in three of the country's 18 provinces would have had to vote against it. The referendum came down to the mixed province of Nineveh, where 55% of the province voted against it. The heavily Sunni provinces of Anbar and Salahuddin voted overwhelmingly against the document. There remains a widespread belief amongst Arab Sunnis, as well as amongst followers of some Shiite leaders, that the vote in Mosul, Nineveh's capital, was tampered with. With Sunnis largely voting against the constitution, the results of this month's new National Assembly elections have become even more important. More than 2 years after the invasion, Iraq remains what it has been for much of the last century, a country on the brink.
You've been listening to a Free Speech Radio News documentary, Iraq, Year in Review, by David Enders. I'm Aura Bogado. Thanks for listening.